sunsets and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile.
Women of color in Montreal, we come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
To Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM.
We are live in studio with Spitfire hosts Victoria and myself, Mercedes. We also have a special in-studio guest, Emily Gunn. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also, today is a super special show in that we're doing the annual CKUT funding drive, Waves of Glory. And this year, Spitfire will raise $400 to contribute to the station. Yay. So call in, make your pledges. This is a great gift idea to donate on behalf of a friend or loved one and give them the thank you gifts that you will get if you pledge. So check out CKUT's pledge page.
We have an awesome program in store tonight. Montreal filmmaker Emily Gunn is here with us in studio tonight to talk about her documentary, Cave Birds, and also women of color filmmaking in Montreal. Super psyched to have Emily with us tonight. We will also be talking about Shonda Rhimes' new TV series, How to Get Away with Murder.
Yeah, so Shonda Rhimes has done it again. She has given us another show with the complete package. How to Get Away with Murder draws us in with drama, sex, murder, and intrigue. But more importantly, she places a spotlight on the rise of women of color as the main powerhouse of television shows.
Tonight, we'll also bring you an exclusive interview with Ninochka.
Ninochka.
Thank you.
Ninochka Rosca, Filipina feminist author, journalist, and human rights activist on the killing of Jennifer Loud. Rest in peace, Jennifer Loud. Finally, Alyssa brings us an interview with Annette Kissé. Annette is a transracial, transnational adoptee who does not know her birth parent and is working to raise awareness about the challenges transracial adoptees face in Quebec and the rest of Canada. All that and more coming up now on Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Liking what you hear? Donate to CKUT during our funding drive October 23rd to November 2nd. Our goal this year is $50,000, which will help keep those waves of glory coming your way. CKUT's funding drive October 23rd to November 2nd. Waves of glory for your ears.
The sound of a whip cracking is a result of the tip of the whip breaking the sound barrier. Sound has shadow zones based on temperature. It will bend upwards when introduced to cold temperatures. Sound can kill by creating regions of high enough pressure to cause internal injuries in humans. Sound waves cannot be heard in space. This is due to the requirement of a medium for the sound waves to travel through. Keep the glorious waves coming to your ears and pledge to CKUT's funding drive at 514-907-9424 or go to ckut.ca.
Sound, yeah, Estelle, we about to get down. Who the hottest in the world right now? Just touched down in London town. Bet they give me a pound. Tell them put the money in my hand right now. Set up a motor, we need more seats. We just sold out all the floor seats.
Take me on a trip, I'd like to go someday. Take me to New York, I'd love to see LA. I really want to come pick you with you. This 5'7" guy who's just my type. Like the way he's speaking, his confidence is peaking. Don't like his baggy jeans, but I'ma like what's underneath him. And no, I ain't been to MIA. I heard the Cali never rains, the New York's wide awake. First let's see the West End, I'll show you to my bedroom. I'm liking this American boy, American boy. Take me on a trip, I'd like to go someday. Take me to New York, I'd love to see LA. I really want to come pick you with you. You'll be my American boy, American boy. Shopping, maybe then we'll go to a cafe. Let's go on the subway. Take me to your hood. I've never been to Brooklyn and I'd like to see what's good. Dressed in all your fancy clothes. Sneakers looking fresh to death. I'm loving those show toes. Walking that walk. Talk that slick talk.
Welcome back to Spitfire Radio. We are broadcasting live in Montreal. The time is 6:09. It's a really special show. We're raising money for the station tonight, CKUT 90.3 FM. I invite all of our listeners to call in at 907-514-907-9424 or visit ckut.ca and make a pledge. Our goal for tonight is $400.
Yeah.
So call in and support marginalized and underrepresented voices on the radio waves. CKUT is an amazing institution, and we should make sure that it continues to thrive and flourish and, you know, really enrich our community here. So turning now to Mercedes.
Thank you. So I have recently discovered that I have a newfound obsession with a new television show. This is unusual for me in the sense that I do not follow one show more religiously than the other. After all, media has become such that there is a wide range of shows for one to choose from, kind of like an all-you-can-eat buffet for your eyes. Even with the eclectic selection of television shows, there is one executive producer I must acknowledge and give her credit where credit is due. Shonda Rhimes has done it again. She's given us another show with a complete package. How to Get Away with Murder draws us in with the drama, the sex, the murder, and intrigue. But more importantly, she places the spotlight of the rise of women of color actresses as the main powerhouse of the show. All in all, what I can say is move over, Olivia Pope. There's a new sheriff in town, and her name is Annalise Keating. Hashtag I'm being biased, just so you know. Annalise Keating, played by Viola Davis, is a criminal law professor as well as a defense lawyer with her own practice. She's an independent and resourceful woman who keeps her wits about her in times of crisis. That is to say, when her case seems to be on the brink of unraveling, Annalise gets her team in gear to provide a surprising plot twist. But not only that, drama in the courtroom is not the only thing she has to deal with. Aside from dealing with the five overly ambitious law students that have now joined her team from her Criminal Law 101 class she teaches, Annalise has her own secrets to deal with as she takes on a case that changes both her life and the lives of her interns, and not for the better. Seeing Viola Davis thrust into the main character role is both refreshing and positive for the way that women of color actresses are being cast in television and film. It is a hop, skip, and a jump away from the quote-unquote mammy figure, the broken black woman, the angry black woman, and every other stereotype that these women can be typecasted into. It is breaking down these barriers to allow women of color to have a presence, a voice, and to take up just as much, if not more, space as their white counterparts on the screen. Women of color are now able to have characters that reflect both the personal and professional lives they may share with their characters on a more realistic level. Everything shines through via the actor's portrayal, the strengths, the weaknesses, the happy with the sad. The only difference is that it is done in a manner that the actor can interpret with dignity and respect that they have for themselves and their craft. They do not need to feel dehumanized, but rather can feel confident that the audience can see them as the person they are and not solely as the character they play. Furthermore, they are no longer a background character, where they have no personality and very little screen time. Their character is their own, and they are recognized for it. In an interview with New York Times reporter Amy Wallace, Davis discusses her experience as being a woman of color in Hollywood and the various roles she's been given. Notably, the role that seems to have thrust her name into Hollywood circles was in the film The Help, directed by Tate Taylor in 2011. Davis played Abilene Clark, one of the two maids with a presence on screen, the other being Octavia Spencer, who plays Minnie, her best friend. On her experience, Davis says, quote, "I have been given a lot of roles that are downtrodden, mammy-ish. A lot of lawyers or doctors who have names but absolutely no lives. You're going to get your three or four scenes. You're not going to be able to show what you can do. You're going to get your little bitty paycheck, and then you're going to be hungry for your next role, which is going to be absolutely the same. That's the truth." End quote. She later goes on to say, quote, "I am a woman of color of a certain age and hue. I don't see anyone on TV like me in a role like this. And you can't even mention Halle Berry or Kerry Washington." Close quote. This last part is in respect to the audience's perceptions and acceptance of Davis in her new role as Annalise Keating, which in itself is an interesting point to make. Yes, she is another woman of color that is in a main role, similar to that of her Scandal counterpart Kerry Washington, who plays Olivia Pope, but one may not think that her skin tone would be another basis for which she is accepted in her newfound role. Another point in the article that I would like to point out is when Davis tells Wallace, and I quote, "Casting is only complicated for people of color. I listen to really smart Caucasian women all the time talk about how hard it is for women over a certain age, and it doesn't overshadow their work. When you're white, your ability is not overshadowed by your rhetoric. When you see what the deficit is, then you have to do something about it. I see the kind of work that needs to be put out there in order to make change. Do I think there is a crisis for women over 42? Absolutely. But a 25-year-old white actress who is training at Yale or Juilliard or SUNY, Purchase or NYU today can look at a dozen young actresses who are working over age 40 in terrific roles. You can't say that for a lot of young black girls. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Close quote. Davis's strides to try and change the way that women of color are perceived in certain roles and highlights Davis strides to try and change the way that women of color are perceived in certain roles and highlights the truths in her words. Although this is not something she should feel responsible for on her own, it is something that she should feel proud people are beginning to talk about. After all, baby steps are better than no steps.
Thanks so much, Mercedes, for that.
You're welcome.
Don't forget to call in, guys, 514-907-9424. Make a pledge and support community radio.
Any other reasons why it's so important to donate to CKUT?
Well, there's all those little things. A radio station does not pay for itself, although it might seem counterintuitive after you've bought the equipment so long ago. But, in fact, there are many places the money goes. If you pledge, where your money is going to be going to is the building rent and bills, electricity, internet, telephone, etc., renting the broadcast tower and transmitter, new equipment and equipment repairs. Our gear is in heavy use, meaning faster wearouts and more chances of weird errors. Plus, it's in need of constant updating and maintenance. We have production equipment and we have office equipment. And then there's all the gear we wish we had. CKUT wants to grow. Miscellaneous expenses like CDRs, turntable needles, office supplies, and so on and so forth. Not to mention the salaries of our 7 full-time staff, 2 part-time staff, and work-study staff. Without these folks, the station would likely be in complete disarray. So pledge.
Again, the number is 514-907-9424. 907-9424.
You are listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on 90.3 FM. You're tuning in to the Sounds of Glory Funding Drive edition here at CKUT. And as it's been said, it's very important to donate because without platforms like CKUT, Spitfire wouldn't have a place to be. Well, it would anyway, but you know, it's still great resource to have. And CKUT's airways reflect communities of Montreal. All of our programming developed by the members of many different Montreal communities. We offer an authentic and relevant slice of life in our vibrant city. And that being said, I'm going to turn it over to Victoria and Emily.
Thanks so much, Mercedes. So Emily Gan, she is a visual artist working primarily in photography and video.
Are you about to read my bio?
Oh my god, I'm going to do it. Okay, no, I'm not. All right. Okay, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
Well, let me just start by saying I'm so happy to have Emily in the studio today. I kind of quasi met her a couple weeks ago, maybe for the third time.
Maybe.
Because we were both participating in a film pitch contest that's hosted by the Cuban Hat Collective and RIDM. And so I invited Emily to come into the studio and talk about her work, specifically a film that she's currently producing, directing, called Cave Birds. So why don't you just...
Cave Birds. Yeah, it's a documentary film. It's my first time directing, I guess officially. And, oh, I have to talk into the mic. Okay, got it. But it's a film primarily about my family, actually. And it's about my dad and my family out in Malaysia, where my dad is from. But the kind of twist in it that I often talk about is that I'm looking at the natural resources industry out there, specifically something called bird's nest farming. And so if you know anything about weird Chinese delicacies, there's one called bird's nest soup, and it is made out of a nest that is spit out by a bird from Southeast Asia. And so you're basically eating saliva that's been double boiled and added, I don't know, they add either salt it's either savory or sweet. So a lot of times people have it as a dessert. But yeah, so my family is in that world. And I'm using that as a vehicle to talk about home, to talk about family, tradition. And I just got back from Malaysia about 3 weeks ago. So yeah, I'm kind of settling back into Montreal.
So how long have you been documenting the story? Like,
ooh, it's been since about the beginning of 2012. And yeah, it's been a long ordeal. I went first on a research trip with my dad, and then I did the whole independent artist thing and applied for grants and got a few rejections, and then I got a Canada Council production grant for my film, so that kind of gave me an extra push and motivation to keep going. And so since then, 2012, I went for about a month, and then this year, this past year in 2014, I've been to Malaysia twice, and now I'm kind of moving into late production, moving into post-prod, as they say.
That's really cool. So I'm really curious, like what's the process like? Is it that you, in 2012, started witnessing the fact that your father was going to invest in this bird harvest, like this bird byproduct, mass, agricultural, yeah, potentially problematic, environmentally problematic business venture.
Yeah.
And then you wanted to engage in documenting this, and
yeah, well, I've always been in the periphery of the film world. I've worked on other documentary films, but never as the director. I was there as a photographer, sound recordist as well. And then knowing that I wanted to have an idea, I wanted to also do a film about my dad as well, because he's quite the character. And a lot of my work has always been related to family or archiving or documentation, and it just kind of felt natural to move through there. It's hard to really answer why I kind of, I just went by instinct. A lot of the times it's just through feeling, and I was like, this is what I'm gonna do because it's interesting me at the moment, so, and I can, so that yeah, that's the luxury in all of this, is that I had the choice from the get-go to do it.
What has been sort of the biggest challenges so far throughout the production process?
Well, it's a lonely process, and it's a really long process. So a lot of times it's motivation as well, because it's also wrapped into just daily living and needing to also find ways to fund. I mean, we both pitched for our films because we need some type of support that's not just our own, drive to make the films, but also finances, facilities, people, support in any shape, way, or form. And that has been probably the most challenging. Yeah. And it's just long. So you go through these lulls, and then I have like these like concentrated times of inspiration, and then I'm like, oh, and then you kind of crash, it's like waves. It's like, it's life. Oh boy.
Definitely. And in terms of the fact that your film is so personal, also that it, as a woman of color, like, would you say that there are particular challenges in terms of the subject matter, or that you're a female woman of color director in finding the support and finding financial resources?
It's so tricky with women of color. It was also when you started using that word with me, it's almost like in the way that when we apply to all of the different art councils and applying for money for public funding, it's always visible minority. So then I always considered myself just visible minority, and then color could also, I like the word, I like the term, because it has so many different meanings. It could be just color in the sense that it's like cultural as well. And what was the question again? Whether or not, and so when I was thinking about
this question. A lot of times people, because it's a personal film, they always initially ask me, well, how much are you in the film? Because it's, you know, it's about my family and so my answer is always, well, no matter what, I am in the film, but I'm not directly imposing myself there. I'm there framing. I'm there asking questions. People's reactions are they're reacting to me and to what I'm saying. So no matter what, I will always be the constant in the film. And so without the idea of me actively in the forefront of my consciousness being like, I am a female Chinese Canadian director with like Chinese diaspora, blah, blah, blah. It's not in the forefront of my consciousness when I'm creating, mm-hmm. but the fact that I am that and mm-hmm. I am this makes it relevant. And ethically, then when I start thinking about it, then I'm like, oh my God, my choices, like this is getting heavier than I thought. This isn't just a personal creation work, you know? So I don't know if that answered your question, but that's just kind of like where my head is and in this bubble that I've created for myself.
Well, that kind of leads into another question that I had
Sweet.
For our
Good
honored
segue.
Guest here, which is I sent you these questions mm-hmm. the night before, so I feel like I'm not just like attacking you right now. But so here at Spitfire, we like to think of what we do here as bias for us media. So basically, we are making radio. We're telling stories about us and for us, and
right on.
There's something to that, and I'm just in the world of documentary where there is sort of this tradition of maybe not the most conscious forms of storytelling about the other or different communities. You know, it's not necessarily predominantly motivated by the bias for us model. And so when I saw your film, I was just like, wow, this is really, you know, this is really beautiful. It's very courageous. It's
thank you.
It seems to be in the world of bias for us. And I was just wondering cool. what your thoughts are since, you know, in terms of like personal storytelling and then also maybe representing yourself in the film industry here and, you know, talking to other filmmakers and, you know, just your thoughts on that.
Whoa. It's like, where do you start with that, though? You know, bias for us. One thing that I do think about is having that the actual this place for to talk about it openly without feeling like we're without the self-censorship that usually kind of happens in everyday life. But then there's also the point where I do want people outside of our thinking to watch and listen as well, to be able to know that this exists and to tie that into how I'm trying to, what voice I want for my film. I don't want to underestimate one, because I'm also looking at my own personal culture, my family, like who I come from, but I'm also looking at them from so many different perspectives as Canadian, as like a first generation Canadian. And then when I go there, there's the culture shock because I'm not used to what they are, but then we share the same blood. And to be able to, I'm going all over the place now, but, to be able to talk to them and to present it in a way that is not, that's kind of breaking down generalizations and mythologies based around a certain culture. And when I meet expats overseas, you know, everybody is always kind of trying to justify what, like why they live out there. Or like if I met an expat from China, they're like, oh, China's not the place that you think it is, kind of thing, you know? And it's a really fine line. Like, how do I represent my family from a personal standpoint, but also from my own references? And so I'm almost, and yeah, I'm placing myself in so many different bubbles as like a female, as a visible minority, a woman of color in Montreal. But then when I'm there, it's like I'm suddenly a part of them. And then when I'm presenting them to others here, then suddenly I'm this vehicle between these two worlds.
Yeah, it's funny how you put visible minority into quotations.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily like the most, I identify as a visible minority.
No, but it's just, it's the rhetoric that we're, that I grew up with, you know, and then we have to kind of, because of the infrastructure that's laid out and how we apply for things and how we write things, how we ask for money, it's always within a certain vocabulary. So it's like, how do we break that down? And part of me was like, nervous about these like different words, different vocabularies to describe, different metaphors that we can use, and I'm a believer that in the way that we talk can, and the way that we use words can change how we end up thinking over time. So
definitely. So we're gonna have two last questions. I'm really curious. Okay, and we could just do this really quickly, but I'm really curious about like what you thought about the results of the Cuban hat this year.
Oh,
did you see the films?
I didn't. I only watched a few of them.
Okay.
I'm really happy that my friend, I have a friend who was in there too, and he got in, Eduardo.
Oh, cool.
Props. And this is live radio. No, I'm kidding. Well, something in our correspondence was mentioned that no woman of color was selected,
or persons of color,
or
women of color. Singular, like female, or singular directors.
Yeah, exactly. It is based on votes, and half of it is also based on the jury. And I don't understand how the algorithm goes, but I'd like to think that it's not, you know, it's completely fair. There was some other films there too. You mentioned all the ones like Megan Johnstone's film as well. There's another one about like a girl in Southeast Asian kind of film as well, another female director, but none of them were selected. And I can't strongly say one way or the other what was going on. Last year's, for instance, the three people selected, there were two films that tied in the Cuban hat, and they were both women directors. And I also like the people who head the Cuban Hat Committee, the Cuban Hat Project, and they're extremely, I actually talked to them because I was at the press conference when they named out the contestants, the top five. And they're like, we really respect the 50-50 vote. And that is, they have an algorithm, and he says, we'll show it to you. They want to be as transparent as possible. There it is.
Cool. Awesome.
I'm wondering what you think, but anyways.
You can interview me next month. Emily, thanks so much for talking, sharing about Cave Birds.
Yeah,
really
thanks.
Looking forward to seeing it on the silver screen at some point.
Oh, yeah. Well, post-production... Hopefully by the end of 2015, I'm going to have picture lock in a film.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, I can be the answer. I'm ready to dance when the vamp up. Then when I hit that dip, get your camera. You perceiving that bitch, shit the pamper. In the DM, that young sister beacon. The bitch who wants to compete in. I can freak fit that pump with the peep in. You know what your bitch become when her weave in. your peeps and sitting at lunch if you're treating. Kick it with your bitch who come from Parisian. She know where to get mine from in the season. Now she wanna lick my plum in the evening. And fit that tongue, tongue to deepen. I guess that can't get any in. I guess that can't get any in. I guess that can't get any in. I guess that can't get any in.
We are back. That was 212 by Azalea Banks. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, a monthly radio show hosted by Women of Color on CKUT. So we're just going to take a few brief moments to talk about why we value Spitfire. Victoria, would you like to start as the veteran member on the show?
Sure, Mercedes. Okay. So context, guys, 514-907-9424. Or you could visit ckut.ca and make a pledge. Don't forget to put our names in quotations so that, you know.
S-P-I-T-F-I-Y-A-H.
Spitfire, yeah. So we're trying to raise $400 here. So super excited to see the dollars roll in this hour. Okay, so I'm just going to level with you. Like, why is it so important to support CKUT 90.3 FM and, you know, keep shows like Spitfire alive? Well, honestly, guys, like, Spitfire, I've been doing Spitfire now for, what, 4 or 5 years, something like that. And I think one of the, okay, straight up, you could show up at the station and you could be like, I want to learn how to make radio. And any of the wonderful staff upstairs will, you know, I don't know, I'm sure there's a procedure, but they're basically eventually going to teach you how to make radio. And you get to meet all these really amazing people who are, you know, making radio 24/7, 7 days a week. And you can join shows and, you know, sort of like learn about music and media making and journalism from sort of the marginal level of just being an average person. So it's like super amazing that way. It's such an open community. It's really great. So when is that? How is that even possible? I don't know. And for me personally, like, it's just, you know, it's really helped me just like put myself out there and learn skills and meet really amazing people on Spitfire. And I've grown so much from it. So if you guys just support Mercedes, take the mic away from me.
No, I want to hear you continue.
You cry.
That's live radio, folks. No, but it's true. I mean, thinking back, I'm having like a nostalgic moment here. Leave me be. Thinking back, it was something that I kind of stumbled upon accidentally on purpose, if that makes sense. I was looking for a way to get involved. I didn't know how to get involved in terms of being at school, trying to get involved in the community. And then whenever other members, Malek, hi Malek, if you're out there, had handed me this flyer, and I said, why not? Seems interesting. And then after the first meeting, I said, well, this is it. I found what I need, where I belong. What I think is important is validated by other people as well. And I don't have to kind of filter anything. Whereas sometimes there's, depending on your audience, you have to make sure that, you know, you're not crossing too many lines that people feel awkward about or feel need to take your words, take them out of context, and then shoot them back in your face. So, yes, it has happened. So it's kind of this relief that's coming into, I don't know, a community radio station such as Spitfire, and knowing that you have this shared thought process or a shared connection of what it means to be a woman of color and why it's important to have a voice. And stations like CKUT are only as strong as its individual parts. Same way for the community and the show. Like, the only way the show works is if all of us work together. And I like that feeling. You know, it's like a radio family, if you will, if that makes sense.
Yeah, man, Spitfire is amazing. CKUT 90.3 FM is amazing. So call in 514-907-9424, or you can check us out on the web, ckut.ca, make a pledge. Now we're going to turn to the death of Jennifer Loud that took place October 11th, 2014 in Alangapo, Philippines. So the 26-year-old Filipina transgendered woman was allegedly killed by Private First Class Joseph Scott Pemberton, a 19-year-old United States Marine. And Pemberton was in the Philippines as part of regular military exercises. His ship was docked at Subic Bay Freeport, which was the former home of the Subic Bay Naval Base, which was at one time the largest U.S. Navy base outside of the United States. And, we're going to go to an interview now with acclaimed Filipino expatriate, feminist, author, journalist, and human rights activist Ninoch Carrasca, who will shed light on the significance of the killing of Jennifer Loud. I'm really grateful to have had the chance to speak with her this past weekend in Queens.
The killing of Jennifer Loud, it's such a horrendous thing in itself, you know, by itself. But it's also so what I would call an event that encompasses so many of the contradictions embedded in Philippine society. One, the most basic, the most fundamental, is what is our attitude towards non-conforming genders? That's number one. Where did we get this kind of hostility? No, we have to understand that, because the bedrock culture does not allow any kind of hostility to non-conforming genders. Non-conforming in terms of the Western binary gender system. In our bedrock culture, there is no such thing. It's not a binary gender system. So we do have to understand. We do have to understand the where that comes from. And then the second is the class aspect of this. What kind of life is she compelled to live, both as a transgender and as a person of low income? Yeah. And then fourth, the overall geopolitical aspect of it, because this is a U.S. soldier who killed a transgender person in the Philippines, you know, in an area that has been constructed for the entertainment of American troops. Alangapo. That used to be one of the rest and recreation centers of the American GIs during the war in Vietnam. So you have all of this history around the issue. And it goes back to the beginning of colonialism in the Philippines and to the present. It's a very, very complex issue. And that's why the emotions around it are so very intense, very intense. We, as members of AFIRM, we tend to look at this as part of the patriarchal culture brought to other places and maintained by American imperialism very directly. Because at the same time that Jennifer Laude was being murdered in the Philippines, there was one Native American transgender being beaten up unconscious in Brooklyn. The same day, if you take the international dateline, you know, the divide, at the same time. And so it is like, Jennifer's culture, bedrock culture, respected, you know, being a transgender was a matter of respect. And the same with the Native Americans' culture. Native American culture accepts the two-soul person, you know, man and woman in one. And Philippine bedrock culture accepts four genders.
Is that the Balatha that you were writing about?
The four genders, babae, which is woman, lalaki, which is male. The binabae, the woman, man, and binalalaki, which is the man, woman. Accepted. Four of them. Yeah. So, what has imperialism, colonialism first, and then strengthened by imperialism and maintained by imperialism? This heteronormative patriarchal view of genders, which is absolutely necessary to private property, necessary to imperialism, necessary to the maintenance of empire, because you have to be according to the norm. You know, that's the paradigm. So our position is that we do have to break this. We have to break it both in the Philippines and in the United States itself. Because if we do not break it in the United States or in countries of the first world, it will continue to be exported.
Welcome back to Spitfire. That was Ninochka Roska discussing the death of Jennifer Loud that happened on October 11th. The time is 6:46 p.m. and it is 12 degrees outside with intermittent clouds. So, as we've been saying throughout the show, please donate to keep CKUT alive and support shows like Spitfire. You can call in at 514-907-9424 to make a pledge. Now we're going to go on to an interview with Annette by Alyssa.
I spoke with Annette Kasai. Annette Kasai was adopted from the Gondar region of Ethiopia at the age of one into an Anglophone Quebecois Canadian family from the eastern townships of Quebec. Her adoption was arranged via private contacts her parents made while they were doing relief work during the famine and war of 1984 and 85. Due to the limited information available about her background, Annette Kasai views adoption as extremely political, and being an adoptee a unique political experience. She identifies with being a lost daughter because of the missing connection she has with her country of origin and also her birth family. But, as an idealist at heart, she believes that adoptees, especially women adoptees, occupy a special position in societies, and that they have powerful and compelling messages that need to be shared and heard in order to bring about social and political justice. You can find her Facebook group on Facebook. It's called Ethiopian Adoptees of the Diaspora. I'm so happy to be talking to Annette Kasai today. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Why don't you start out by telling me your story? You were born in Ethiopia, and take it from there.
Okay, so I was born in Ethiopia in late 1985. I think it was December, we're not really sure. And this was during the war and famine that was happening. So I'm from the northern part of the country. I was adopted by a contact. Well, basically it was a contact of my parents who kind of arranged the adoption. And so I arrived in Canada just over a year later. And I grew up in the eastern townships, so about a couple of hours east of Montreal, in a very white, homogeneous community.
And how did you come to realize that you were disconnected from the circumstances of your birth? How old were you? When did you first start asking those questions?
I was a baby when I arrived in Canada. So, I mean, I grew up just not really knowing anything about my background because my parents didn't really know that much, and there was nobody that looked like me either. So I kind of just, I think when you're, you know, that's the reality that you know is just, you know, that you, I mean, you just arrived here, you don't really know how, and your parents are white and they love you. And so I didn't really think about my adoption that much just because, well, I just didn't have any information. So I sort of created a block in my, it created a block in my head where I didn't, because I didn't know anything about my background and I wasn't surrounded by black people either. So I didn't really think about these issues that much until at 17 I moved here to Montreal, and then people started asking me where I came from, and I was just like, I'm from here. People are like, no, you're not. So I was like, oh, I'm from Ethiopia. And so that kind of started the whole process of me slowly, you know, thinking more about my adoption, because people always made me, like, they made me realize that I wasn't from here. So that made me think more about, okay, it's true, I'm not from here. Like, where am I from? So that kind of started the process of me thinking more about my adoption.
And then did that process lead you to take steps to kind of try and figure out where in Ethiopia you were adopted from, and, you know, your date of birth, and if you have any siblings?
Well, again, because of the lack of information that I had, and because I didn't have contact with Ethiopians when I moved here in Montreal, I mean, there was all these pending issues that I had that I didn't really know how to resolve. Like, I knew I needed to go to Ethiopia, and that I needed to find out more information. I didn't for a long time, and it wasn't until I was 23 that I actually went to Ethiopia just to see the country. And now, I mean, it's been just. I mean, I was 23 and I'm almost 29 now, and it's only now that I'm actually, like, really facing these issues in full. Because and when you're an adopted adult anyways, I think there's so many issues that you have to go through with yourself, with your family. And so for me, everything has just kind of happened slowly, like in steps. And so it's actually now that I'm trying to, like, sort of find out what actually happened.
For people who think of adoption as a really good thing, you know, bringing children who don't have a home into their homes, or for people who don't really know that much about adoption because they don't have adopted brothers or sisters, or they're not thinking about this for themselves, what would you like those people to know?
That adoption is very complicated and it's very complex. And I think that people that are looking into adoption really need to do their homework. They really need to research adoption and also research adoptees, trying to get information about adoptees and their views and their experiences is very important. And the thing is that when people want to adopt children, they have this very idealistic notion of just, like, saving these babies. But the reality is, it's like, when you adopt a child, I mean, you can love the child as if it was your own, but the child has its own story, it has its own experience that it's unconnected to you. And so you have to know how to deal with that. And as a parent, I think that can be very difficult, because it's a totally different situation from if you give birth to your own baby. So I think that it's important that the parents be more realistic about that, and also just, again, talking to adoptees. I mean, adoptees offer a wealth of information and advice, and I think it's very hard to hear what they have to say sometimes.
So you've been really active in building a community of people who have had a similar experience where they've been adopted but they have no access to their birth records, and so it's very difficult for them to find out where they're from exactly, who their birth parents are, where relatives are. What have you learned through going through that process and talking to other people with similar experiences and sharing your story?
I mean, I'm still processing all the craziness around, like, adoptees just and our lack of information about our backgrounds, and also just the difficulty in being understood within our families and also within society. So I'm still kind of processing all this, but I think the most important thing actually is through talking to adoptees from Ethiopia, from South Korea, from domestic adoptees adopted from the States. Unfortunately, I don't know any adoptees adopted from Canada. But what I learned is that adoptees need to come together and we need to talk about our experiences. I think we offer, like, a very interesting perspective just in society. I mean, also being people of color raised in white families, it's like you're given an identity that's not yours. How do you, like, just a way of navigating life, like on an everyday basis is just very like, it's, I mean, for me it's normal, but it's very interesting. Like we're kind of outsiders within, and there's a wonderful book that's called Outsiders Within, Writings on Transracial Adoption, and I highly recommend this book. It changed my life.
Who's the author?
It's edited by Jane Jong Trunka. She's a South Korean activist. Amazing work, amazing book. So I think that just learning about like everybody's experience has been an amazing thing. But I think the most important thing is just that we have to speak out, actually, because things at adoption policy has to change, I believe, in order to really benefit adoptees themselves, and also there needs to be more training of people involved in adoption, right? Social workers, psychologists, even psychiatrists, because a lot of adoptees have issues with their health, with mental health, and unfortunately, we're often shipped to see like psychologists and social workers, and these people don't know how to deal with us. They just don't know. And so that also creates like a lot of problems with us. Like nobody knows how we're feeling, and our feelings are just kind of like sort of put to the side, like, oh, focus on this, or no. So yeah, there needs to be a lot of education, a lot of resources for adoptees.
Do you think that the media coverage of transnational and transracial adoption helps or hinders kind of the way that the mental health services and the other services that exist for adoptees work? I mean, to me, the perception of transracial adoption is kind of like this do-gooder. I'm going to go and enlarge my own family by saving a life in an orphanage. I know that Madonna took a lot of flack for going to Malawi and adopting children, but, you know, Angelina Jolie is held up as this international ambassador for taking children from a number of third world or poorer countries, and it's seen as this great thing. So I'm wondering what you think of the media coverage.
Oh yeah, the media is problematic, but I think that the idea that these babies in developing countries need to be saved, this is kind of reinforced by just general media messages of like, not, I mean, it's like messages that are not necessarily direct. It's just that, you know, in photos and in advertising, you'll see like, you know, maybe a white man handing something to like this like black lady, or just like people of color are often not shown in an empowering positions, right, in the media. And so it's just that it does something on the psyche, right? Always seeing these images of like black people and other people of color in not powerful positions. So that kind of plays into this idea that we need to be saved.
You've become very passionate about these issues and are working really hard on them. What are some of the things, both in the short term and in the long term, you'd like to see change?
Short term, I want adoptees to come together, speak out, organize. I'm connected to some really amazing activists in the States. If you're interested, you can go on to gazillionvoices.com, a group of really amazing adoptees. And I'm also part of a group of adopted women at the blog, and you can go on to lostdaughters.com. So there's just amazing things happening in the States where adoptees are coming together. They're writing their own stories. They're writing their own therapy books. Like, they're professionals or academics. They're doing amazing research. They're doing films. Like, it's amazing the things that they're doing in the States. Canada, I don't know what, I don't think we're doing that much, but that's why I think that we need to come together, because there's so many experiences that haven't been told, that haven't been shared. Right now I'm in contact with Ethiopian adoptees in France, and it's just amazing for me to meet all these French adoptees that just have really different, they're French, and so they've grown up in kind of a different culture, but we do have a lot of similarities, and I want to hear the music.
I want to feel that vibe.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
Uh-huh.
So that was this month's edition of Spitfire Women of Color Radio on 90.3 FM every last Wednesday of the month. Thank you for all our in-studio guests. Emily, we're out.